Great. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Kara Hutchinson. I'm Senior Director of Marketing and Content Strategy for the Boston Celtics. It's been a great day so far. I hope you're all enjoying it as much as I am. As someone who works in a very male-dominated industry of professional sports, I spend a lot of time in conferences like this, whether it's a sports conference or data and analytics. I'm usually in the gender minority. We're lucky that we have quite a few women working for the Boston Celtics, but I'm not used to a conference like this where I'm surrounded by powerful and ambitious and talented women. So this is very refreshing. And as you've all seen so far today, the Mass Conference for Women is really dedicated to empowering women and making strong connections and allowing us to network and better ourselves both professionally and in our careers and in our homes as well. So. We are very lucky today to have a wonderful panel on strategies for closing the diversity gap. We're joined by some ladies from State Street, and we just heard in the lunch session that State Street is a huge supporter of the Mass Conference for Women, so a round of applause for State Street. And I'll tell you a little bit about our moderator for the panel. Mirta Castropelli is Global Head of State Street's Center for Applied Research. Yes, a little clap for that.
Thanks.
She has written papers, she's won awards, she's helped form public policy, has 14 years of experience in both the public and private sectors. So I'll let you tell her a little bit more about herself and introduce the rest of the panel, but I would definitely encourage you all to read her full bio in your conference program. So I'll turn it over and we'll save some time for audience Q&A at the end. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Kara, for the introduction, and thank you all for being here this afternoon. I'm very excited to be here at the Mass Conference for Women. I'm a big fan of the conference, always an inspiring event full of just wonderful speakers, so it's really a pleasure to be here moderating. I'll start by just sharing with you a little bit about our group, the Center for Applied Research. We are an independent think tank that sits at the top of the house, and our research is designed to provide insights about the future of the investment management industry. And as you heard today, we believe that the future of our industry lies on the success of women. And so I had the opportunity to really do some research around gender diversity in our industry and really think about ways for us to leverage diversity to improve competitiveness. Now, on a personal side, I've been with State Street for about, for over 10 years. In my previous life, I was a global macro strategist in a trading floor. So again, a very male-dominated environment. A lot of testosterone, as you can imagine. So I was able to really feel or face the challenges that a lot of these female professionals encounter in a male-dominated environment. And I gotta say that I have had really wonderful managers and colleagues, male, that have been very supportive. But by far, my most important mentors, sponsors, and as I call them, my cheerleaders, have been senior leaders in our company. So it is my pleasure to introduce today, for me to introduce you to some of these women leaders in our company. So I'll start with Hannah Grove. She's our Executive Vice President and Chief Marketing Officer for State Street. Also, Kathy Horgan, she's our Chief Human Resource Officer and Executive Vice President, and you heard her speak earlier at the luncheon. And lastly, we have Lynn Blake, also Executive Vice President and CIO for the Equity Global Solutions at State Street Global Advisors. So thank you all for being here and for sharing all your insights with us. So I would like to start the panel by asking you to share a little bit more about your experience, your education, your work background, and how that helped shape your career and also your career at State Street. So, Hannah?
Sure, thank you. And excuse me, I'm having minor technical issues with my voice. So. I have an advanced degree from a very well-known university called the University of Life. I I actually had to leave school when I was about 16. My sort of family fell apart a little bit, and I had to leave to support my family and get a job. Now, the good news is I've always had a backup plan, and my backup plan was to enter a very sure profession. I wanted to be an actor. And so that led me to a second career as a world-class waitress. I waited on tables for about 3 years until somebody told me that I was good at communicating. I was also really good at carrying 5 plates at once. So that idea of multitasking was something that I got quite early on. And so from waitressing, I went to PR. From PR to marketing. I had my own little firm. And then ultimately, I joined State Street. And you'll hear from my friend Lynn shortly, but it's amazing. I've been at State Street for almost 20 years. But I think one thing that's always been a constant in my career, because it's very unconventional, is that I've always believed I could, because I learned very early on in my life that no one else is going to do it for you. So that's been really important to me, Myrta.
Me next?
Sure. I've been in human resources all my career, and actually I have a degree in industrial and labor relations. So my choices coming out of college were probably going to law school or going to work in human resources or become a union organizer. That was maybe my third choice. I remember union organizing, there was a reference to like needing to carry a handgun at times, and so I thought, oh, well, that's not really for me. And I actually just wanted to take a break from school and make some money, and I thought maybe I'd head back, and so I went down the human resources path, and I've sort of never turned back. I've worked in a number of different industries, again, always in human resources. I started off in pharmaceuticals. I've went into medical devices. I found my way to financial services about 20 years ago, probably. And you know, part of that was just wanting to try different industries, understand how different things worked, how people actually worked in different industries. And you know, one of the things is there's a lot of commonalities around the issues that happen in the workplace, irrespective of industries. But once I got to financial services, I really enjoyed the I found the intellectual stimulation. The people that I worked with were very smart. They really challenged me to bring my sort of A game every day. And it was hard at times because I didn't always know what I was doing. But I figured it out along the way. But I really just enjoyed the fact that I had found an industry that very much was focused on talent. That really is the product that's being sold. That is really at the core of it. It's about the people. And so to find myself in a role where human resources was so linked to the business strategy, I said to myself, that's really where I want to be. I want to be right in the center of that. And so I've never really looked back, and I found myself at State Street about 8.5 years ago. I started at State Street Global Advisors, which is our investment management division, and then found my way into different roles over time in human resources, trying a whole variety of things, and then recently stepped into the head of human resources earlier this year. So it's been terrific.
Thank you.
For me, when I got out of business school, I knew I wanted to enter the investment management area. Something I was very interested in during my educational years, but I didn't know what and I didn't know where, so I interviewed at a lot of firms in New York and Boston and quickly realized that the sell side industry probably wasn't for me, and so I interviewed at State Street at one point, not having really heard of State Street Corporation and specifically the fact that State Street had a fledgling asset management industry. But what attracted me to the company and ultimately to the role was really the people. the energy, the fact that they were very driven, they were incredibly enthusiastic about the growth potential of asset management within State Street was really compelling. And the fact that it was fledgling, that it was a new organization that had all of this growth opportunity, allowed me to wear a lot of different hats as a very, you know, very young person. And now 30 years later, I've been with State Street the entire time, which I guess some people would say boring, but I would say it's pretty exciting because it's been an amazing career. And I'm asked, well, why have you stayed at the same organization for 30 years, especially during the crisis years and some of the challenging times that the industry and our organization have had? And it comes down to two things. It's still the people. The people are incredibly smart. They challenge me every day. They're highly ethical. And I really enjoy the people that I work with and spend a lot of time with week after week. But after 30 years, it has to be more than just liking and being challenged by the people. It has to really come down to a sense of purpose. And that's what I've really grown to love about my job and the industry is the sense of purpose that it gives me. It really comes down to the mission that we have as an organization, which is to invest responsibly to enable economic prosperity and social progress. And for me, that's a noble thing to do. It means that we're helping people save for their retirement, helping people put their kids through college, helping people buy a house. And that makes me very, very proud of what I do.
Thank you, Lynn. And Hannah and Kathy, anything else you would like to share about the State Street culture and why, I mean, because you've been at State Street also for a long time. What else, you know, we talk about the challenging, the people that you work, the purpose. Is there anything else you want to share with this group about, you know, why State Street?
I think for me, there's always been the fact that it's a meritocracy. And I think that's tremendously important. Kathy expressed it in her case, being able to try lots of different things. I think the thing that keeps you at a company is when you're continuing to learn and be challenged. And we've certainly been challenged. But I think that ability to continue learning has been a real constant.
I guess I would just add, I think, you know, one of the things, and I noticed this from the day I walked into State Street, is there's just a value placed on, certainly on the work and the purpose and the mission of what we're doing for our clients. But there's also a value that's placed on what we as employees do, whether that's for one another, whether that's for the communities that we live and work in, whether it's a focus on any number of different things, diversity, inclusion, that really stands out. It's actually seen as something, I think, that is, it's expected of people and it's valued. And that again, stood out for me as something different, but I think is very core to who we are as a company.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So earlier today, especially in Viola Davis' amazing presentation in the morning, she talks about some of the challenges and failures and how that helped shape her, you know, her experience. Do you want to share, or can you share with us some of the maybe challenges or failures that you have faced and how you have overcome some of those challenges?
Start at the end this time. Yeah, it's a good question. I think most organizations really do aspire to a culture that has meritocracy, that's really rewarding people based on merit and actual performance. But the reality is, there are biases that creep in to meritocracies, unconscious biases, and I think they particularly impact women, and they've impacted me throughout my career. One type of bias that I think is really insidious is the notion of benevolent bias, mm-hmm. where people make decisions on your behalf, not for ill intentions, but they're actually trying to do right by you. They're trying to make a decision that they think is in your best interest. But the reality is they don't know you. They don't know what your decision-making process is. And sometimes those decisions can really impact your career in a negative way. It can be minor, like if a boss or a manager doesn't invite you out to dinner because they know it might create child care conflicts, or if they don't want you, or if they don't ask you to an important meeting because it means traveling across the country and you're pregnant. Those can impact a career in a, you know, relatively minor way, but there can be decisions that are made on on your behalf that are really impactful. If it involves like an overseas assignment that involves a promotion or taking an assignment that involves a lot of travel, and yet a manager doesn't even give you that opportunity because they think, oh, the husband's not going to move, or it's going to create childcare issues if she's traveling so much. So those are certainly situations that I've encountered over my 30 years. And I still see people that even work for me, managers that work for me, sometimes doing that. And I call out that behavior, like, no, don't make a decision on the behalf of somebody else. Give that option to the person.
For me, I've been sort of thinking about this recently. One of the things that I used to hear a lot early in my career, like as a negative piece of feedback, was that I was too nice. And people questioned whether I was able to sort of deal with tough situations, have difficult conversations, those kinds of things. And I always remember feeling bad about being nice. And then I thought to myself one day, why do I feel bad about that? Like, that's ridiculous. Over time, I think people maybe have seen it, come to see it, hopefully, as a bit of a strength, because in the work that I do, a lot of this is about having difficult conversations. And when they don't start off necessarily as confrontational, when you can have discussions, when you can bring people together, when you can find common ground, whether that's being nice or whether that's just being, just a person who can bring things together and look for solutions, I think people have come to see the strength in that, and so I don't hear that kind of feedback as much. I am very attuned to it, though, because I do hear that I think it gets used against women quite a bit. And again, in a negative connotation, but that's coming from a very different lens. That might be a lens that is predominantly male-dominated in terms of how they think about being tough, being firm. And so that's something that I definitely, I used to feel super bad about it. But I've come to realize that actually is who I am, and that's it's fine, and it's a strength.
Yes, absolutely.
I think for me, one of the challenges, particularly in a function like marketing, is that it can be regarded as something that's sort of quite fluffy. Now, trust me, I would love to be in a fluffy world. Life would perhaps be a lot easier. But it's a very complicated world we live in, with sort of 24/7, a constant news cycle. And I think to sort of break into the business and be regarded as an equal from a business strategy point of view, because it's very easy to say, oh, they're the marketing person. And so I think it's sort of really leaning in and embracing what your strengths are. So as Kathy has leant in and embraced her niceness, and Lynn has brilliantly embraced her incredible acumen, I think for me, I decided very early on my value proposition is that I can see the end-to-end across the organization, and a lot of people don't have that view. And then I can take that view and parlay it into a recommendation that I actually think can be rock solid. And then I think the other thing that I would say is that I think women in general, we can be a little risk adverse. We tend to overthink things, and we tend to listen to the voices in our head. Mm. And I don't know about you, but the voice in my head is always a bit of a Debbie Downer and a little bit negative. And I think you have to be able to block that out. I often joke that if there was an Olympic category for failure, I would be Michael Phelps. But what I've realized is that you've learned so much from that. And so any challenge is, in fact, a real opportunity.
Mm. So it's how you see it, right? So you see the challenge as an opportunity. You see your weakness as a strength, as
Absolutely.
A differentiator. And then knowing your value, right? And using that, as your force to move forward. So thank you for that. So, Kathy, I would like to maybe talk specifically about some of the actions or the initiatives that C-Suite is doing to increase gender diversity in our organizations.
Sure. There's a lot we're doing, so I want to just maybe focus on a few things that I think are really, you know, very important. One, I had mentioned in the remarks at lunch, you know, going back a number of years, we set very clear targets to increase the representation of women and people of color in the more senior ranks of our company. We started off at the sort of setting targets for the very top levels, and then a few years later recognized that we also needed to use this same kind of method to build that pipeline. And so we've set targets at about four levels of our company. And there's something very powerful about that in terms of what it does, especially at a company like ours. So being in financial services, we have a lot of folks who very much gravitate to things that are quantitative. And they're also very goal-oriented. You know, they want to achieve what they've been asked to do. So having these targets, being able to measure progress or the lack thereof, be able to drive accountability around that has been probably, I'd say, one of the most significant things that we've done. And it wasn't sort of the easiest thing to get off the ground when we started it. A lot of people sort of questioned it. They said, well, that's not the right thing to do. You're just going to be hiring or promoting women just so that you can achieve these targets. And that's, in fact, not what's happened. What's happened is that we've said to managers, you know, here are all the things as a manager that you need to be thinking about. And if you really want to have the best talent, you have to think about different practices, different ways of doing things, whether that's making sure that you're looking at diverse slates of candidates so that you're considering a whole range of candidates that maybe you wouldn't have if you were just trying to sort of quickly fill a position. We've focused a lot on internal mobility and making sure that we're posting roles so that we're able to really pull that pipeline up through the company. We've done things around unconscious bias training because that the impact of bias is enormous when people are making key decisions, whether that's hiring or promotions or developmental activities, those kinds of things. And, you know, we've actually spent quite a bit of time thinking about issues like pay equity. And one of the things that you may have seen, you know, earlier this fall was that we were cited by the Department of Labor for pay inequities, pay disparities in a group of our employees in our headquarter building. And, you know, this was something that we took very seriously. While we ultimately didn't agree with the findings, because we've been doing our work on this on our own for a long time, we felt like the Department of Labor had taken a sort of very simplistic approach to this. We ultimately decided the best thing to do was to enter into an agreement and deal with it. And we knew we were going to be subject to negative publicity. So it was quite difficult to sort of reconcile all the great things that we believe we're doing, all the progress that we're making, and yet have this other issue. But we felt like we needed to be able to make sure that we were going to focus our efforts and our energies on these important systemic changes that we want to drive within State Street. And, you know, just maybe back to the diversity goals, you know, we believe in equal pay for equal work. That's sort of like, in my view, the most simplistic way to think about equal pay. If I'm doing the same job as a man and we've got sort of the same level of performance, I should be paid the same. That's sort of just an obvious one. To me, the bigger issue around pay equity is the fact that we do not have nearly enough women or people of color in the highest paying roles in our company. That's really the biggest lever that we have to pull. That's why these diversity targets really make a difference. And that's why the work that we do to drive those results is really where we say that's really where we're going to place our big bets.
Thank you. So another thing that is happening at State Street is mentorship, right? Yeah. So Hannah, can you tell us more about your experience mentoring individuals within State Street? Also, have you had a mentor before? And more importantly, what advice can you give to, you know, all of us here in the room about how is the right way to find the right mentor?
Yeah, so let me start. So yes, I've had lots of mentors, and I've had lots of sponsors. And there's a sort of subtle difference because sponsors are people who really intervene and advocate for you. And we all need both. I think the common denominator across both is that the people who are best for you are the people that unflailingly tell you the truth and are really honest. And I think what you find as you grow more senior in your career is less people are sort of honest. They tend to want to agree with you. One of my favorite mentors very early on in my career was not particularly august qualification. She was a former Miss Australia, and her biggest claim to fame was being one of Prince Charles's mistresses. She used to say to me, "You know, Hannah, we're here for a good time, not a long time." It really struck me, because you can take yourself really seriously, and you need to reflect on that. I'm really proud of the work that we've done at State Street. Everybody has access to mentors. And one of the things I would say, if you're looking for a mentor, is try to be quite clear in your mind what you want to get out of it. I think sometimes we feel we need to have a mentor as a sort of tick box activity or a way to network. And I think it's really important to think about, what is it that you want help with? It could be specific, it could be more career development, but I think being intentional is really important. Lynn, Kathy, and I, and wonderful Alison Quirk, who's in our audience, who really got us started in all of this, and has been a mentor and a sponsor for all of us. We started a group called Leading Women, and our goal as EVP women was to sponsor SVP women so that they pay it forward. And I think Gloria and Meryl said this at lunch, that women really have to stand up and help other women. Like, it's absolutely part of what we must do to pay it forward. And we've had seen tremendous results as women have matriculated through that system.
So on the mentor, do you think, So for females, you think it's better to have a female mentor? What's the plus and cons of having a female versus a male mentor?
I actually think it's gender neutral, and you should think of it that way. And to me, it goes to what you want to get out of it. Because the other thing that I would say is, as much as women have to help other women, we can't do it without men.
Yeah.
And so depending on what you want to do, what you want to know, choose the best person. Don't choose it based on gender.
I mean, just to add to that, I think when it comes to things like sponsorship,
yeah,
I mean, you have to have men who are sponsors. They are, I mean, the fact of the matter is, there's more men in decision-making roles in many of our companies, and so that is the group that you really need to make sure that you're focused on. It's super important.
So I would like to switch to Fearless Girl. So Lynn, if you can kind of share with us the birth of the Fearless Girl, what was the motivation behind it, and also your, I guess, our reaction to the impact and the sensation that became Fearless Girl. Is this something that you expected or not?
So yeah, happy to. So I hear she's here. Did anyone get a picture in front of her? Hopefully.
I did, yeah.
Well, we have so many amazing initiatives and very effective initiatives within State Street Organization, but we really wanted to use our role as an asset manager to move gender diversity much more broadly, and that was really the motivation behind Fearless Girl. So we placed the statue of this 8-year-old little girl in front of the Charging Bull on Wall Street. But to give you some context, it wasn't just about marketing, it wasn't to elevate our brand, and it wasn't even to address the social inequity on Wall Street, but it was a very deliberate call to actions to companies in the portfolios that we own to change gender diversity at the board level and at the senior leadership level. Because companies, we know, can only be effective, and boards can only be effective if they have good diversity. And diversity is measured in lots of different ways, like experience and education and skills and culture and gender. And we focus specifically on gender in this call to action because of all of the research that supports that better gender diversity leads to better financial results. It's been quantitatively shown by organizations like McKinsey and MSCI and Peterson Institute and the Clayman Institute of Stanford, and there's a whole host of others. But despite all of that evidence, we all know the numbers. Currently, only one out of four companies in countries like the US, the UK, and Australia have one out of four have no women on their board, so almost 25% of the companies. And we intend to change that as an asset manager. And so what we did earlier this year, symbolized through the Fearless Girl, is to write to hundreds of companies, the hundreds of companies that have no women on their boards, tell them our position on gender diversity, and tell them our expectation is that they will increase, they will add at least one woman to their board, or will vote against the board of directors, will vote against that directorship. And that's exactly what we did. So the first half of this year, there were about 460 companies that didn't pass our screen, all of them in the US. So 460 companies that had boards coming up for re-election, and there were no women on their boards. And 400 of those companies, we voted against the directors. About 40 companies we engaged with and understand that they will add women to their boards. And 7 this year actually added women to their boards for the first time. And you can say 7, that's a small number. But it's a beginning. And the even more profound impact is other large asset managers followed suit. So they have the same proxy policy and the same call to action as we do. So there's now something like $15 trillion in assets under management that will require women on boards. So it's been incredibly powerful. It's 10 months since we placed the Fearless Girl on March 8th, International Women's Day, earlier this year. There's still so much excitement, so much energy around her. We're still getting great letters from all people, young, old, men, women. She has her own Google stop. She's got her own Wiki page. She is there at least through February, through the efforts of people around the world through a grassroots petition on change.org that was launched. At last count, she said something like 5 billion Twitter images, 750 Instagram images. I mean, she's certainly a phenomena. And it's because the image of this, you know, this little girl has really resonated in a very deep, impactful way with people. So it's something that we're very proud of as an organization, and we're very proud of the results.
Thank you. And I have a fun fact about the Fearless Girl that I heard recently, that the artist behind the sculpture of the Fearless Girl is actually a Latina. So for all the Latinas in the room, so now I'm going to switch to a not so good topic, a serious topic, which is the sexual harassment in the workplace. With obviously the Me Too movement and the fact that it's bringing attention or exposing a lot of these issues that are happening not only in the entertainment business, but really across industries. So we'd love to hear your perspective about sexual harassment and abuse in the workplace from the corporate, from the corporate angle.
I mean, I would just kick off by saying I'm so proud of the women that have spoken out. That Time cover this year, I think we'll all frame in a way, not that you'd ever want women to be on the cover for those reasons, but I think they're so brave. Because I think that it starts with speaking up. And as, you know, Meryl and Gloria explored at lunch, the power equation is such that many women don't feel that they can. And I think if there's... I'm the marketing person, right? So I'm trying to find the glass half full, that more women will be empowered to do so. So I think it's tremendously important. I think I love that hand gesture that Meryl has given, because I think it's going to go. Like, watch out.
Yeah, you know, I would say I think it is really, it feels like a bit of a watershed moment in terms of you can't really take a step back from where we are right now, which is a very good thing. If I think about it from a corporate perspective, you know, the thing that I feel very good and confident about is when issues come up around harassment, which they do, we take a really very sort of clear black and white line on it. We don't have any tolerance for it. The thing that I worry about are the things that don't come to our attention, because I know there's many of those that are out there, and I know how difficult it is for people to speak up. So this idea of the silence breakers, I think, is very powerful. It doesn't necessarily make speaking up any easier to do, but I think it creates a bit of a community that people are, you know, you can see that there is a way of doing this. The other thing that I think a lot about, and we've spent some time on, is, you know, there's a responsibility to listen up and not just have to speak up. And we need managers who are attuned to what's happening, and they're listening for ways that may not be obvious necessarily people coming in and saying, I need to report that such and such has happened. They need to understand when they see a change in somebody on their team. They need to understand what the dynamics are. That is a responsibility of managers. And we need more managers. I think that's the other thing that's coming out of what's happening now, is that I think people are wondering, they're thinking back on things that have happened. Should I have said something when that happened? That, I think, is very, very important. And maybe the last thing I would say is that I think it's also just shedding a light on, you know, what is tolerable and what is not tolerable, and what should people be subjected to? No one should be subjected to feeling harassed at work. And I think, you know, for a long time, people sort of said, well, it didn't cross this line. Well, that line is way too high. Mm-hmm. You know, we need a different line. And I think those are the real positives that are going to come out of it. But I think we have a ways to go.
Yeah, I would just add, I mean, it's been incredibly empowering, I think, to women, but it's also given men great food for thought. It's made them evaluate their own behavior, and even if they haven't crossed that line, at least think about things that they do that now they might think are, oh, that's uncomfortable to a woman. I think Al Franken's comments today are a great example of, you know, when he put his arm around a woman and maybe hugged a little too tight, he thought that was appropriate. But for a lot of women, most women, that's pretty uncomfortable. And so it's an opportunity for men to reevaluate the way they act, which is really, really empowering to everybody.
Yeah, thank you for that. Definitely such an important topic and so visible right now, right? You cannot read the news without, unfortunately, mm-hmm. another case. So I would like to talk about some of the day-to-day practices that we do at work. So Lynn, if you can share some advice about what is the effective way for women to speak up at meetings. I know your world is, again, very male-dominated. So again, any practical steps for us to make sure that female voices are heard in a meeting?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's an ongoing challenge, I think, for a lot of people, because the reality in a lot of industries, I think specifically in investments, you have a lot of very smart, very type A personalities, and the reality is still that very often women are the minority in the room. So you need to have your voice heard. And the approach that I've always used is to be very prepared, to understand the content, to have done my homework, which then gives me confidence that I can have strong opinions, I can have intelligent opinions, I can have informed and interesting ideas and a strong point of view. And that, through the years, has given me confidence and a voice. And that's how you develop, ultimately, your brand, your reputation, your credibility with your peers and with clients. It doesn't mean you need to be the loudest voice in the room. You can have a quiet, confident voice and be just as effective. Based on, I don't know if any of you have done Briggs-Myers and evaluated your personality type, but when I did mine, it leaned more toward being introverted versus extroverted, which was a little bit of a surprise, not a huge surprise, but a little bit of a surprise. But introverts in a meeting often act very differently, where they listen more than they talk. They think before they speak. But introverts in a room full of extroverts can be very powerful. There's a book that was written by Susan Cain called Quiet. It's a really interesting book, and it evaluates leaders in the context of those personality types, and both can be equally effective, and you need both, actually, to really to be effective, because you can't have a lot of those sort of table-pounding people that talk a lot. You need people that think very thoughtfully and then come to decisions sort of later. So some of the ways I've helped with that challenge.
I think I would just add two things. One is don't actually go to a meeting where you don't have a role, because I think that's something, that's that benevolent bias again at play that Lynn referred to. We're often saying, well, I'm going to bring some talented women to the meeting, but then they don't have anything to do. So if you haven't had the chance to do your homework and get up to speed, think about asking a question as a way to having your voice be heard. Mm. And then I always say, and I'm not very good at this myself, but try going to a few meetings without bringing a notebook. I think we always tend to sort of show up, but I look at my male colleagues and it's like, oh, yeah. No need for a notebook.
So they ask you for a pen.
Right. Yeah. Can you write that down? Yeah. So I think that's a good technique as well.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
So another critical skill is asking for feedback, right? Mm-hmm. And it's very important to advance in your career, to learn from your mistakes. So can you offer any advice again to us in the room about what is an effective way for women specifically on how to ask and provide feedback?
Yeah, so I think, you know, asking for feedback, I think, is important. And I think, you know, I've always found it helpful to have a few people who, you know, I have a lot of interaction with, or who might see me in various forums or meetings or what have you. And I try to make it manageable, because sometimes it can be overwhelming. Like, hey, can you give me some feedback on how I'm doing? And people are like, oh my God, like, you're doing fine. And I think you have to make it more, it's just easier for the person to give you feedback. And so I think what's effective sometimes is doing it in more sort of like bite-sized chunks. So even if you're like in a meeting or on a project team, you know, if you say like, can you, you know, we're going to go into this meeting, I'd love some feedback after, or even after the meeting, to say, you know, how did that go? Like, I had a dissenting point of view. Did it come across strong enough? Give me some advice. I think if you can make it, again, a little bit more narrow, you're going to find people, it's just going to be easier for people to do it. And I think it just has to become a habit to be able to get that feedback. And the other thing I would say is when you do ask for the feedback and you get it, you know, you really have to receive it with appreciation. And it may not be what you want to hear, quite frankly. And sometimes that's the very best feedback that you can get. You know, Allison is here in the room, who I worked for. And a lot of times I would go in and I'd be like, oh, okay, can I have some feedback? And she would give it to me. And I would be like, wow, that was really hard to take. But she was right, and I, you know, it took me a while to sort of get used to that, because it's hard, and it's like, it's again, it's a habit. You have to get into the habit of asking for it. I think giving feedback yourself is also a difficult thing to do, and sometimes that's really important. You know, especially with colleagues, with people that you work for, people working for you, I think that can be very intimidating, especially when it's feedback that maybe isn't, you know, what they want to hear. And one of the things that we've done at State Street is we have a little bit of this technique about, you know, how to do that. And it's really about, here's what I observed, here's the impact that it had on me, because no one can argue with that. It's the impact on you. And here's one suggestion I have for you about how you might think about this going forward. And just those simple sort of three questions, I use it all the time. If I know I have to go into a conversation, a critical conversation with someone, I put it in that frame, and it really helps just be able to communicate it, and I think in an effective way.
And this is where your being nice actually helps, because you're thinking, you're having that empathy, you put it in a way that the person is going to receive the feedback in a positive way.
That's right.
So it's an example of where your weakness is actually a strength. Yep. So now I want to switch to family. So I'm a mom of a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old girl. And I know that you also have children and have raised your children while having very active professional lives. So do you have any advice for working moms trying to balance it all? And is that really, you know, is that even possible?
Yeah, I mean, I tell everybody I joined State Street when I was 8.5 months pregnant. So my daughter grew up with me and my career at State Street, but I find work-life balance a bit of it's a myth, it's like a unicorn. And I think that it also puts too much pressure on women because ultimately it's not really sort of work-life balance, it's more of a compromise. And only you can decide where your line is. And, you know, ultimately, you have to have that sort of North Star of what's really important to you and carve that out very early. And that can be quite difficult when you're more junior in your career because you think those decisions might have an impact. Mm-hmm. But if I think back on the things that I would regret, I think the thing that I regret the most is that I wasn't as definitive earlier in my career about what was most important. And it came home to me when I picked up my daughter when she was about 5 from school, and they wouldn't give her to me because they'd never seen me at the school. Mm-hmm. I had to sort of, you know, produce all sorts of forms of backup ID. No. Crying helped. No. But I do think that so many women torture themselves over this because they have to be the best at both. And I say, actually, you don't. Just do what works for you and be true to what's important to you. And the rest, I promise you, will work itself out.
So I do, anything else you want to add?
The only thing I was going to say, and you know, I think I didn't think about this so explicitly maybe earlier in my life, but I do think really thinking about what this division of labor is at home is really important. Yeah. And you know, really understanding like who's your, you know, whether that's with your partner and figuring out who's doing what, that again, at the time it was sort of a little bit of a struggle, but it is really, really important. I think I heard Gloria Steinem talk about this, that this idea of what is sort of women's roles outside of working at home and what our men's roles really, really need to sort of deconstruct and think about very differently. I think that is one of the things that's going to make the biggest difference. But for example, in my life with my husband, if we didn't have that real partnership, this real division, I would have been in an insane asylum. So and there were times, I mean, there's moments, you just have to sort of like muscle through them, but I think that part is really important.
Yes. Well, thank you very much. So I do for sharing, and yes. Kara, hopefully we have some time for a couple of questions from the audience.
Open it up to audience questions. Anyone with questions, if you want to just step up and form lines, I have a microphone, but I'd love to kick it off with a question. Thank you for that, first of all. That was start to see diversity and inclusion committees popping up everywhere, which is a great first step, but it seems like some organizations like State Street take it very seriously and are doing wonderful things in that space to diversify the organizations, but some it seems like they're just checking off a box and they're doing it because it's something that they're supposed to do. So do you have any practical advice, anyone on the panel, near to you as well, for some of us that are maybe in more junior level roles or somebody who's outside of an HR role, what can we do to make sure that our companies are taking the diversity and inclusion initiative very seriously?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be happy to start and happy for others to weigh in. I mean, I think, asking questions, raising the issues, talking to, people who you think can be advocates for this, I think is very important. Yesterday at the Workplace Summit, there was a woman from the head of HR from Salesforce, and she talked about the fact that, you know, she has had
people who just make, they figure out who are going to be the advocates for this, and they've made connections and they've raised issues and they find the people who they think really can help them carry the message on some of this. I think that is very important. I think just asking the tough questions and saying, why isn't this a priority? I think can go a long way too. I know that can be difficult, but I think, in today's sort of war for talent, which it is, this is really an imperative for companies to figure this out. I just do not think it's going to be a viable strategy in the long term to sort of say, well, we do this because we think we have to, or it's a check the box. So those are a couple things that come to mind.
I would also say the business benefit. I mean, the fact is employee networks are not just a sort of social connection device. They, for us at State Street, are avenues of client insight. They're ambassadors for recruitment. They're drivers of engagement. And often they're also pioneers of new markets. And so you start talking in those terms, and I think companies lean into it.
Any questions? Hi, I have a question about what Gloria or Merle mentioned about lights and fire lights. And also, to me, that seems like a little bit of a paradox, because that's assuming that what the management looks like right now can bring or shape up the status quo. So, what is your take on that? And how much of a diversity issue is because of the pipeline that there isn't enough people of color or
Yeah, I mean, I think I think people like to say it's a pipeline issue, that it's a supply issue. I don't think that's right. I think it's about how you define what that pipeline is, how you define what are really the things that you're looking for, the kinds of skills and experience, and you widen the lens on how you're thinking about that. I think it's easy to sort of say, gosh, I wish we could do better, but we can't because we don't have the pipeline. I think that's an excuse.
And a specific example is it's often cited at the board level, super senior level, obviously, but often a board will say, well, we can't find any people of color or women or, broadly diverse candidates. They're just not qualified. And it's because their definition of qualified is so narrow. It's typically, they have to be a CEO. But guess what? 96% of U.S. publicly traded companies, CEOs are white men. So if that's the only universe they're looking at, of course they're not going to find qualified candidates. So it's all about thinking out of the box, looking at potential and skills in a different way, and that solves the pipeline problem in a big way.
I think it is important, though, if you think about, really deep in the pipeline, women that are coming, young women that are coming up, how to think about the kinds of skills that will be important for the future. I think encouraging, girls to stick with math and science and coding and robotics, those are the kinds of things that are really, that is the future. And I think there's a lot of reasons why I think girls opt out of that. And it really is something that I think, again, when you're thinking about this broader pipeline, is really important to be able to explain why that isn't what we need to do, and really encourage girls to stick with this.
Thank you. I thought this was very insightful. I'm delighted to see several men in the audience. I think that's wonderful. So my question has to do with male allies. I understand from what you said that you have certain metrics, and so that helps get men involved, I'm sure. We also heard earlier how diversity training can backfire. You mentioned a number of things to be aware of, like benevolent bias, for instance. So how do you communicate some of that to men? How do you get men involved in a way to help make a more inclusive environment?
I think a whole variety of ways. One is by instead of making it a requirement, just of all of our leaders to think about this as something that they need to do. That would definitely be one way. I think the other way is to really spend time, trying to understand different points of view and bring men into the dialogue so that it doesn't feel like they're being excluded from this. They really are a key part of the solution. And so, you know, really spending time through our leading women group, for example, that Hannah mentioned. We have a group of male allies also at the executive vice president level who some have volunteered, some we've tapped because we think they're great advocates, and some we've tapped because we think they're not great advocates. And we need to help them see a different way of doing things. So they're probably all wondering, like, which group am I in? Why have I been invited to join? And we'll keep that secret for right now, but I think, you know, it's as much really trying to get that message out, and a lot of it is conversations, but I think, you know, a lot of it is just the tone the company needs to set about what's our expectation of leaders, full stop, whether you're a man or a woman. And then I think for a lot of men, they need help. They need to figure out, how do I do this? How do I reach out to other networks? How do I think about bringing different people onto my team? And how do I manage that? That's hard work.
So basically what you're saying is we've
definitely invited this male allies group to, we've gone out and reached out to them. I think the other thing we've done is through, like, our employee networks, through the Professional Women's Network, which we have, which is one of our biggest networks. We've made it clear that that is open to all employees. And I would say over the last couple of years, we've seen an increasingly greater representation of men coming to those events. And partly the reason they're coming is because those kinds of events, to what Hannah had said, a lot of our networks are focused on things like mobility, how you learn about getting another job, networking. So they're smart. They see this as an avenue of meeting other people in the company, of advancing their own careers. And so I think just by that, it also just, it's bringing more people into this discussion. So I don't know that there's any sort of one solution, but it is absolutely essential to have men as allies in this.
Thank you.
I work on the asset strategy team, so I have the opportunity to speak with companies on the topic of gender diversity. One of the most best outcomes I think that have been from starting through this whole conversation, in addition to the 40% of companies that are already committed to increasing female gender diversity at the board level, have been companies that don't screen out for us because they have female directors already, but their message to us is we're not done. We need to do better. So my question to you is, what would your advice
towards
gender
parity? 50-50 by
2020. Right. Because too often, I think we talked about this around, you know, you hear a lot of, well, we already have three women on our board, so we're good. And I think this idea that that isn't, you know, that that's not what we're going for. This idea, I think, of pushing to parity is the direction that we need to go into.
And critical to push that message down to the organization, because it can't just be tokenism. I mean, we've certainly seen that in European countries where, yeah, they have great diversity at the board level, but then they have no diversity at the senior leadership or at the company level. So we need to make sure we're pushing that dialogue too, is that there needs to be diversity really across the entire organization. And yeah, 50-50 ultimately is the goal.
And I think those
maybe
points...
64.
Yeah, right.
Can we not?
Yeah,
that's
a little right.
I mean, come on.
I was just going to say, you know, I think at the very entry points of companies, we all have to be focused on what's happening. You know, we know, for example, at State Street that almost like right out of the gates, women don't progress up through the company as quickly as men. And so you have to say, what's going on there? Why is that happening? Those are the places that I think we really need to dig in, because that is really about continuing to build the pipeline and continuing to make sure that we're getting women progressing into the most senior, highest paying jobs in our company.
I think 60-40 is a good mantra for all of us, so we'll take that away. So, Lynn, Kathy, Hannah, Mirta, thank you so much. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.